Chapter 4, Yet Phoenixes Rise. Roy is doing his best not to worry. Ed had called the office 2 days ago and said that something had come up and he wouldn't be home. The lines are all recorded, of course, so the rumors that the two of them are sleeping together are chugging along nicely. Ed has dropped off his radar before, for weeks at a time even, not just days, but it's always in the middle of nowhere, far away in cities where Roy doesn't have much personnel or influence, not in Central. His mother swears up and down that she hasn't heard anything about Ed, and while he wouldn't put it past her to lie to him, he doesn't think she's lying about this. Which means there's nothing for him to do but wait. He hates waiting. Mace is getting antsy, desperate to go digging, to dig his nose into places where it doesn't belong, to try and find out what happened. Roy told him to knock it off, but he's pretty sure Mace didn't listen to him, and is just being sneakier about it. A couple of days is nothing. He's sure Ed is fine. Trisha wakes up in a windowless room with a cement floor, likely a basement. She's back behind her son's containment circle, and she's lying on a cot. Edward is just barely visible out of the corner of her eye, speaking to two Ishvalan women who keep looking towards her. They're arguing about something, but she can't make out the words. It's probably about her. She fades in and out of rationality, of consciousness, but it all seems too good to be true, too confusing to be real. It's a good thing she often goes missing for days at a time, otherwise pride might grow suspicious. She wonders what excuse he'll give for why his secretary is missing. Trisha can't cross the barrier, but objects can, and the Ishvalan women keep coming back and bringing her things. The old woman is called Jida, and the younger one is Yadira. Jida is there often, sitting in a chair in the corner of the room and watching her with a bottle of liquor by her side and a cloth and a needle in her hands. She speaks, her voice crackly with age, but her tone kind, and Trisha can't understand her, doesn't speak more than a couple words of Ishvalan, but it's nice to have company anyway. Yadira comes and goes, white hair pulled back into a bun and tucked under a scarf, like it will hide her dark skin and red eyes. She has hard eyes and a thin mouth, and she leaves at night and returns in the afternoon. She speaks Amstrian and brings warm, fresh bread and clean water that she pushes across the barrier. Everything Trisha eats gets thrown up, and it's impossible for her to die of starvation anyway. She's tried telling them not to waste their bread, but Yadira had huffed and translated her words for Jida. The woman had cackled and let out a quick rush of Ishvalan. She says embroidery hurts her hands, but baking you bread makes them feel better, Yadira says, amusement around the curl of her mouth. Besides, Ishvala teaches that to be hospitable is to step into his light. It would be wrong of us not to feed you simply because you do not need it. People do not need many things, but a life of needs is a sad life to be had. Trisha flinches, curling up on her cot, her whole body tacky with sweat, even as she shivers under the thick blanket they'd given her. Why are you doing this? I'm exactly the type of monster your god warned you about. Yadira is silent for several long moments. Then she kneels on the cement floor and opens her bag. She gently rolls a bottle of water across the barrier and uses a fire poker to push across a small bag of what Trisha thinks are chocolates. What an unnecessary, silly thing to give the thing detoxing in their basement. What a kind thing to do. Finally, she says, "We care for Edward, and he asked us to protect you." "He's a sinner, too," Trisha whispers, because she loves her sons with all she has, but they are alchemists. They tread where only gods should go, And so, by Ishvalan standards, they are worse than sinners. We're sinners and I'm a monster. You shouldn't be helping people like us. A small smile breaks out across Yadira's face, like she can't help it. And Trisha doesn't understand. You are someone in need of help, she says. And my God is very clear what I am supposed to do with people like you. If I turn my back on you, if I smack away your outstretched hand, then I am no follower of Ishvala. Trisha's eyes fill with tears, and she turns her head into the cot, trying to hide them. I don't deserve your help. I've done such awful, terrible things. Ishvala will weigh your actions against the balance of the world in the next life. In this one, you are someone I can help, so I will. If Ishvala sees fit to punish me for my compassion, then he's no god of mine. She hears the sounds of Yadira rising and picking up her bag. Then her soft voice. Sleep well, sister. Daughter, mother, monster. You are safe here. Ed has been holed up in Gabby and Aviv's apartment for days, trying to work out a plan that doesn't end in everyone being killed. Aviv has to go to work. It's too suspicious if he doesn't. But Gabby and Saif have been staying up with him, trying to help. Lust has been, too. If they weren't focused on devising a plan with their new timetable, Ed would be focusing on how incredibly awkward it is. Lust leaves each night, unwilling to face Aviv just yet, but she can't avoid the others. Saif doesn't speak to her. He just stares at her. It's unsettling for Ed, and he's not even the one it's happening to. Gabby has taken a different approach, cheerfully pretending like Lust is just another guest in her house, and not the failed resurrection of her boyfriend's late sister. One of Ed's favorite things about Gabby is how willing she is to roll with the weirdest things that life can throw at her. His mother is in the building's basement, trapped within his alchemical circle. She twists from raging to weeping, periodically vomiting up red water, but she's finally settled on tired exhaustion, which Lust says is a good thing. It means Trisha is winning her fight against the effects of the red water. Ed visits her, and he wants to stay with her, but half the time seeing him only makes her angry, thanks to the red water that's still in her system. So he visits only when Jida or Yadira give the okay. It's for the best, but it still feels like a betrayal, and he's betrayed her enough already. Focus, Lust says, tapping the space in front of him. She's not wearing her form-fitting black dress and gloves. They'd been torn and bloody when she'd followed Edward back here. She hadn't seemed concerned, and Ed had meant to fix it for her as soon as his head stopped spinning. Or even just to remind her that she was a powerful homunculus and could fix it herself. Instead, the next morning they trudged up from the basement to see an Ishvalan dress and sash laid out on the kitchen table. She'd hesitated, but Gabby had walked into the kitchen and without hesitation or fear, picked them up and pressed them into Lust's hands. Ed has to admit that she looks a lot more comfortable in these clothes than the tight black dress she wears into battle. Sorry, he sighs. I know, she interrupts, but worrying won't help your mother, or your brother, or the rest of Amstrus. I'm often gone for long stretches of time, but Sloth isn't. We'll be okay for another day or so, but then they'll notice she's missing, and they'll figure it out that I mean to start a war, and act. We're starting a war, he corrects. Winry and Al should be here by morning, greed in tow. There's more, something Winry hadn't felt comfortable telling him on the phone. He'd almost asked about the countryside, just to prompt her to speak in his and Al's code, but he figured he had enough to worry about. Whatever trouble they're bringing with them, it'll have to wait until they get here for him to do something about it. Lust sighs and rubs at her temples. He's pretty sure homunculi can't get headaches, So it's just a human habit she picked up, or has remembered from Layla's life.
I wish I knew what condition your mother will be in. She's strong. I think she'll still be strong when she recovers from the red water. Stronger, even, maybe. I don't know how red water interacts with a human soul, but I'm assuming nothing good.
I didn't mean to make a warrior, Ed says, frowning. We were only trying to make a normal mortal body.
Making bodies that can contain souls is hard, Lust says. If you had made a normal human body, then her soul would have eaten it up in the attachment process, and your transmutation wouldn't have worked.
Ed is not a homunculus, and he definitely has a headache. You're sure we can't just go kill this father guy and call it a day?
Only if you don't want to die in the attempt, she says dryly, then frowns. Speaking of fathers, we should probably get yours.
That's the worst thing Lust has ever said to him. Why?
He's carrying the other half of the Philosopher's Stone, she says. And he made this mess. It's only fair he helped clean it up.
Obviously, Lust is right. But the very idea of accepting help from that bastard makes his arm hair stand up on end. I'm not saying I'm willing to doom the entire country to avoid dealing with my dad, but I'm not saying that either.
Lust arches an eyebrow, not bothering to hide her amusement. After we kill Father, you can kill your father, but we need him first.
How are we even supposed to find him? He asks plaintively. Like you said, we're a bit down to the wire here, and I haven't even seen that asshole in over a decade. He could be anywhere.
I'll find him, Lust says, getting to her feet.
Ed blinks, startled, because apparently she means right now.
I can sense him, almost, because of all the souls he carries. I'll be quick, and hopefully Father won't make a move before I get back. Try not to die. We have a deal, and you can't fulfill your end if you're dead.
I'll do my best, he says. Is it really safe for you to go out there? What if one of the other homunculi find you? Lust pulls off her borrowed clothes, her black dress sliding across her body with a spark of something that's not quite alchemy.
I know how to stay hidden. Don't cause too much trouble while I'm gone.
Her eyes skitter to the living room, to where Gabby and Saif are working on translations. Ed moves to touch her shoulder, to comfort her, or maybe to tell her it's okay to tell them goodbye too. But she's out the door before he gets the chance. He sighs and bends over to pick up her discarded clothing, carefully folding it into neat squares. She'll want these when she comes back, he thinks. He hopes. Envy lives with the constant pulse of rage underneath his skin. Has been like this since his creation, since Hohenheim tried to bring back his dead baby and got him instead. But this is unacceptable, unforgivable, and he's seething red. He'd always suspected Lust. Ever since Greed had left, she'd been too quiet, too pliable to be entirely real. Now Sloth is missing, and he'd found the puddle of red water, and he knows what it means. Lust is a traitor, and she's going to force Sloth to become a traitor, too. He should go report back to Father, or at least Pride, who's so close to him in his cushy mansion with his cushy Führer title. But he's angry, and he wants to take that anger out on someone. And they won't let him. They'll try to restrain him. He doesn't want that. He can't kill the sacrifices, and he can't kill those who have the potential to be sacrifices. Edward Elric is at the center of this mess. He has to be. The son Hohenheim had to replace the one he lost, to replace Envy when he figured out he was a monster and not a man. He can't hurt Edward, or his snap-happy almost-lover, or the little girl he calls his sister. But there's that man, with glasses that fail to hide his too intelligent eyes. He's been snooping, coming dangerously close to causing problems, coming dangerously close to being too much a hassle to keep around. He's the closest thing Edward has to a father, and if Envy doesn't get a father's love, he can't see why Edward should. He'll eliminate the man who knows too much and tear away yet another parent from the Elrics at the same time. Good. Maybe once he kills that man, once he feels his warm blood beneath his hands and watches the light fade from his eyes, maybe then he'll be able to calm down, to think. Until then, fury fills his lungs, and the urge to kill something makes his fists clench. He's not alive. He doesn't have a life. He doesn't see why anyone else should. It's dark, the middle of the night, but they're almost to Rush Valley. They should be there a little before midnight. Then they'll have an hour until they can catch the next train to Central. Winry had made some noise about swinging by her apartment to check on it. They're almost back to his brother, and to whatever the thing they made is. Edward thinks it's their mother, but he's not so sure. Hope seems like a dangerous thing to have, considering the circumstances. There's a blanket bunched over his thigh, and Winry's head is lying on top of it. Her legs are thrown over Greed, pinning him to his seat so he can't move without waking her. Martell and Beto are asleep on the seats across from them, tilted against each other. Teacher, Sig, Docheletto, and Roa are in the compartment next door. No one quite trusted anyone enough to be on their own, which is why Greed's crew is scattered amongst them.
I can hear you worrying,
a gruff voice says quietly, and Al straightens, looking towards Greed. He's got his head tilted back against the seat, sunglasses on, breathing deep and even. He doesn't look like he's awake until he smiles, and Al wonders if he was ever asleep in the first place.
You're interrupting my beauty sleep.
Sorry, he says quietly. Winry shifts, and Al places his hand against her hip. She stills, then sighs, falling back into a deep sleep. Greed reaches over and squeezes his shoulder. Al can't feel it, not really, and Greed knows he can't, but he's doing it anyway.
Worrying won't save anyone. You've got lust, and you've got me. Add us to you and your crazy brother, and we stand a decent chance against father.
We could all die, he says tiredly. Greed snorts, clasping his hands behind his head.
Maybe, maybe not. If dying scared you, you wouldn't be where you are right now.
Dying should scare me, he says. But Greed's right. He and brother are scared of a lot of things. Death isn't one of them.
I guess. I think you and your brother are smart enough to know the scariest things in this life aren't on the other side. They're right here. Don't be afraid of death. Be afraid of life. He grins. It'll kill you.
He's a suit of armor. He doesn't have any expressions. But Ed can always tell when he's scowling. Greed must be able to, too, because he lets out a soft chuckle, quiet enough that he doesn't wake anyone up. Greed's kind of an asshole. Al thinks he likes him anyway.
The doorbell rings. They're not expecting anyone. Gracia rises, but Mace puts a hand on her shoulder and gently pushes her back down.
I'll get it, he says, and she frowns but doesn't argue. It's late. The kids are already asleep. Or, well, Alicia is asleep, and Nina had graciously pretended to be asleep for the first 10 minutes after bedtime. Then, taking out the flashlight, they all pretended she doesn't keep under her bed and continued reading. No one coming at this time of night has anything like good news. He's half expecting it to be Roy. But when he opens the door, Edward is standing there. Ed, he says. Because he's okay. He's standing right in front of him and not lying dead in some alleyway. But then his common sense kicks in, and he's reaching for his knives. Thankful he hadn't changed out of his uniform yet. He rang the doorbell. Ed wouldn't do that. If he was worried about startling them, he would have just called out to them as he came inside. You really do know the pipsqueak, the thing with Ed's face says, but it doesn't even bother to imitate his voice. I thought I'd at least make it inside before you figured it out. Oh well. Where's Edward? He asks dangerously, mind flashing. His wife and two daughters are inside. He can't let this thing get past him, and it must be a homunculus. He hopes it's only imitating Ed and not wearing his skin. It moves towards him, and Mace's aim is true. The knives sink into the thing's throat. It makes his stomach roll to see his knives in Edward's neck, even though he knows this thing isn't really Edward. The knives don't do anything. They don't even slow him down. It pulls out the knives like it's nothing, and Mace stumbles back. Gracia! He shouts, panicking. Take the girls and run! Mace cuts himself off with a harsh gurgling sound. He falls to his knees, raising his hand to his throat. It's been cut, and his blood falls warm and slick over his fingers. His vision is going dark, but he can't die. Not here, not now. His wife needs him. His children need him. He has important work to do, and he can't do that work if he's dead. The homunculus grips his shoulder, forcing Edward's face into a cruel smirk. Don't worry, I won't kill your family. Yet. I want to see them mourn you first. Mace has to say something to that. Wants to go running for Alicia and Nina, but he can't. He hopes they all know how much he loves them, since it seems he won't get another chance to tell them. Envy hangs out on the Hughes' roof, waiting. It doesn't take long. Less than a minute later, the wife's anguished cries pierce the sky. He can't feel anything. Not really. But this is as close to happiness for him as it gets. Gracia wants to clutch her husband and sob, wants to break down completely, wants to slit her own throat and settle next to her husband, never to rise again. But she can't. She'll have to figure out a way to manage living, even though it feels like someone reached into her chest and yanked her heart out, even though it feels as if she's died along with her husband. She has two little girls upstairs who have just lost their father, Nina for the second time. And she won't deprive them of their mother, too. Whoever killed her husband might still be close, might still be around. She swallows her sorrow and fear, grabs Mace underneath his armpits, and drags his body inside. She bolts the door shut, gives herself half a minute to lean against it, to catch her breath and tell herself that this is just a nightmare. Then she gets to work. She drags Mace's body into his study, biting her lip to keep from crying out when his blood covers her hands, and she loses her grip, his body falling with a dull thump. She tries again, grabbing him around the waist and pulling him along until she reaches his study. He's still warm. If she doesn't look at him, she can pretend he's just unconscious. She can ignore his dull, sightless eyes and the still heart beneath her hands. Gracia has barely locked the door to the study when she hears small feet behind her. Mom? Nina asks, eyes wide. What's going on? She spins around and she's covered in blood. There's blood all over the floor and she doesn't know what to say, what lie to tell, and instead can't think of one at all. Nothing. Go back to bed. Alicia is huddled into her sister's side, hand fisted in Nina's nightgown. And Gracia sees the moment when Nina processes the blood, how much of it there is. She grabs Alicia and twists her, so her face is pressed into her stomach. Where's Papa? For a second, the tidal wave of grief threatens to barrel her over, and Gracia's knees almost buckle from the force of it. But she takes a deep breath, desperately shoring up the strength she needs to keep standing. Go back to bed and stay there. Don't argue with me. It's important. Nina isn't stupid. Far from it. Her daughter is a literal genius. She knows something bad has happened, even if she hasn't figured out exactly what. If she insists on discovering the truth, short of barricading the door, Gracia doesn't know how to stop her. Okay, Mom, Nina says quietly. She bends and picks Alicia up, and the 5-year-old clings to her big sister. We'll go back to bed. Gracia wants to kiss her or hug her, wants to hold her children in her arms to remind herself that not everything is lost. But she's still covered in their father's blood, so she doesn't dare. She waits until Nina carries Alicia up the stairs, then bolts for the phone. Roy is her first choice, of course, but when he doesn't answer his home line, she knows that probably means he's still at the office. She almost dials him there, but hesitates. She doesn't want the military coming here just yet. She knows that her husband, Roy, and Edward were talking about things that the military couldn't know about. She's assuming that's why he was killed. If that's the case, then she can't make this official, can't let the military be the first ones on the scene, and any call she makes on official channels will be logged and possibly recorded. There's a payphone down the street, and that would at least raise less red flags. An incoming call from an unknown number. Maybe no one would look at it too closely, but she can't risk it. Can't leave the house and leave her children unprotected. Not that she's much good against anything that can kill her combat-trained husband. But she's at least another body they have to get through first. If Roy's not available, then Ed's her next best option. Ed, who's been missing for the past few days, for unknown reasons. Roy doesn't know where Ed is, and she can only think of one other person who might. She picks up the phone, dials, and waits. Saif Residence, says the bubbly voice of Catherine Armstrong, better known as Gabby. Do you know where Edward is? She asks, skipping right past the pleasantries, her voice tight and scratchy. Please, something terrible just happened. There's a beat of uncertain silence. Gracia isn't above begging. I can get a message to him, Gabby finally says, and Gracia lets out a breath she hadn't realized she'd been holding. Tell me what's wrong. If Mom hadn't been so distracted, so frazzled, then Nina knows she never would have let her go that easily. If she'd had more than a second to catch her breath, she'd ask herself when Nina had ever been so well-behaved, had ever listened without understanding, and the answer would be a big, fat never. She goes up the stairs, then bends down and whispers in her sister's ear, I need you to be quiet, okay? It's gonna be scary and awful, but I need you to be silent, understand? Alicia nods against her shoulder. She's not good at being quiet, but unlike Nina, she is good at listening. Nina shifts Alicia's weight to one arm and reaches up her sleeve. She grabs the piece of chalk she'd tucked there before heading downstairs and makes a simple circle. She keeps a tight control on the reaction, releasing the excess energy as heat instead of light so her mother won't notice. The wall melts open, steps rising that lead through the kitchen and to her father's study. She hesitates before stepping into the study, but knows that every second she takes is precious, and goes through the doorway she's created. With another quick circle, the house is back to normal behind her. Nina had been expecting it, had known what she was going to find the moment her mother had hesitated to answer her, but the sight of her father's corpse is enough to leave her breathless. Keep your eyes closed, she says, and puts her sister on her feet. Don't move. The circle drawing water from the air and for water to ice is painfully simple, and it's easy to combine them, even with her shaking hands. She activates the array and coughs at the suddenly dry air, even as her father's body is covered in a thick layer of ice. Somehow, that makes it look even more grotesque. How long has he been dead? Alicia woke up at their mom's scream, which hadn't been more than 5 minutes ago, and it couldn't have taken Mom that long to find their dad. 2 minutes at most. 7 minutes, hopefully a bit under.
Brain tissue starts dying after 4 minutes without blood circulation. She's stalled that by freezing it, but that's not going to buy her more than an hour or so. The slash in his throat is obvious, but she'll have to repair his brain cells too. Except she doesn't know how. She's not Winry. She's not a doctor. Brain cells don't heal, not naturally, and she doesn't have enough medical knowledge to make them. She can probably repair his throat. That's simple enough, for a given definition of simple. But if she tries to mess with his brain, she's more likely to make it worse than make it better. 7 minutes isn't so bad. 6 minutes, more realistically. Maybe even five. It should be fine. He'll be fine. Maybe. But Nina doesn't really have any other option, so she'll just have to hope for the best. "Can I open my eyes?" Alicia asks, voice quavering. "You don't want to," Nina says. "But you can if you think it's worth it." She walks over to her father's desk, yanking a handful of papers off his desk and grabbing a marker, then a pencil after another second's thought. Alicia makes a sound like a cut-off squeak, and when Nina glances over, she's looking at their dad with her hands over her mouth, tears welling in her eyes and then spilling over. Nina doesn't have time for tears. She has work to do. "Is Daddy gone?" "Don't worry," Nina says instead of answering her question. "I'm going to bring him back." She draws another circle on the door, and then the door disappears into the wall. She can't risk Mom interrupting them. This is too important. She sits next to Papa's body and spreads out the paper, sketching out circles on them. She'll need two if she's to do this properly. One to repair his body and one to bring his soul back from the gate. The first is easy enough. It's repair work. It's something no one's done before, but hey, it's scientifically manageable. The second part is a lot trickier. She knows the circle for it, at least, has seen the inside of Alphonse's armor. But that circle is too simple. It needs more variables. Nina doesn't blame Ed for going with the simple circle. At 9 years old with a missing leg, she doesn't think she'd have been able to think up a proper circle for soul alchemy at all. And he did. But she's not bleeding out. She has more time, if not by much. She knows this is dangerous and stupid. She saw what happened to her brothers when they attempted human transmutation, what it cost him, and what they lost. But she's older than them, and she doesn't have to make a body from scratch. Not like they did. Papa's body is right there, is mostly intact. She just needs to fix it up a little. The human transmutation part is small. It's almost nothing. The hardest part is soul alchemy and, well, who better than her to attempt to twist soul alchemy and equivalent exchange in her favor? Well, okay, realistically, her eldest brother. Ed's performed soul alchemy twice so far, but she's had it done to her. She doesn't talk about it. She pretends she doesn't remember what happened to her, what Sho Tucker did to her. But she's too smart not to figure it out. Her soul has passed through the gate before. As a passenger, not as an alchemist. She's not going in blind like Ed was the first time. She knows what she's looking for and what she has to do to anchor her father's soul to his body. This is something she can do, she thinks. If she's wrong, it doesn't matter. She has to try, even if it ends up costing her everything. She's lost one father. She won't lose another.
Gabby liked Mace Hughes. He cared about Edward and only tripped over her name once and never let his eyes get caught on Aviv's burn scars. Now he's dead.
What's wrong?
Saif asks in Ishvalan, frown intent on his face. Gabby opens her mouth and doesn't know what to say, what to do. She's wary around Saif, just a little. Doesn't think he'll hurt her or Aviv, but still unsure what he'll do. For now, while he's recovering, while Edward is sticking his nose into all manner of things, Saif is content to stay with them, to help Gabby with her translations and wash up after dinner. But it's all a stopgap measure.
She pretends not to hear them arguing, late at night when they think she's asleep. Aviv's a lawyer. He's good at arguing. But Gabby doesn't know how much headway he's making. He's trying to convince Saif that maybe being a serial murderer isn't the best choice right now. Saif doesn't seem like he's buying it. All holy vengeance and pain and pulsating loneliness that Gabby knows they're just barely taking the edge off. Saif loves Aviv. He's his brother's wife's brother, which by Ishvalan custom binds them as closely as if they were born from the same name. But Aviv cannot replace a people, replace a culture, replace a whole country that was nearly wiped off the map. Aviv has made peace with his past. Saif hasn't even accepted the war's over, because for him it isn't. And Gabby doesn't know what that means for him, for them. She stopped talking to her brother for the part he played in the Ishvalan War. If she doesn't shun Saif for willingly choosing to be a killer, can she continue to do the same to Alex for being one unwillingly? Gabby, he snaps, placing his hand against her back. What's wrong? She shakes her head. Now isn't the time to get distracted. And pats his chest as she walks by and out the door. I have to go talk to Edward. Then I have to make a phone call. Aviv is asleep. He has to be up early to prepare for a trial tomorrow. She wants to wake him up just so she can hold him. Gracia Hughes is living her worst nightmare. When she gets downstairs, Ed is leaning against the barrier he's created and talking to his mother. Tricia is leaning on the other side, so that they'd be touching if the circle wasn't separating them. She doesn't look angry or crazy or scary. She just looks like a tired young woman. Tricia sees her first and frowns before jerking her chin in her direction. Ed twists to see her, and his smile slides off his face. You need to go to the Hughes' house, she says quietly. Mace Hughes is dead, and whatever killed him might still be around. Ed's face crumples. Then he takes a deep, controlled breath and smooths it out once more. Tricia is saying something, trying to get her son's attention, but Gabby doesn't have time to linger. Ed will be on his way soon. She's almost tempted to ask Saif to go with him, but she thinks that might just make things worse rather than better. She runs back upstairs and Saif is waiting, scowling with his arms folded. Her hands are shaking as she dials. She calls home sometimes, of course. She can't abide by her family's lifestyle, the way they made their fortune off war, off slaughter. She just can't stomach it. But her parents are still her parents, and she does love them. Armstrong residence, says the crisp voice of their head of staff. Get me my brother. It's an emergency, she says. The pause goes on a touch too long. Then she says, Of course, ma'am. Less than a minute later, Alex's voice fills her ear. Gabby, what's wrong? Are you hurt? I need you to do me a favor, and you can't ask any questions. You just have to do exactly as I say, she says, heart beating loudly in her ears, because they haven't spoken in years, and the last time they did, it didn't go well, but she needs him to do this. Of course, he says without hesitation. What do you need? He's still a war criminal. He still didn't manage to walk away when he knew better. Damn the consequences, but he's her brother, and he loves her. Maybe it's enough. They pull into Central, and they're one of the last people still on the train. Their very strange group exits, and Winry yawns, leaning back so every vertebra on her spine cracks. Where to now? Out blinks. He knows Ed is hiding at Aviv and Gabby's for some reason, and having this exceedingly strange group of people show up at their apartment would be the best way to blow their cover. I vote the Hugheses, Winry says. I haven't seen the girls in forever. You want all of us to show up at Mason Gracia's front door? He asks dryly. Winry considers that, looking them over. Izumi raises an eyebrow. I'll go to the Hugheses, Winry amends. We really need to split up. We look absolutely ridiculous together. Al, you go to Aviv's and find Ed. Then find out what the hell is going on. Greed, go with him, since I'm assuming Lust is with Ed. She looks at Greed's minions, or friends, depending on who you ask. You guys head to Canal Street. Find a brothel masquerading as a bar run by a woman called Madame Christmas, and tell her that you're friends of Edward Elric. She'll let you stay the night. Her eyes fall on Izumi and Sig, and she crosses her arms, then brightens. You guys go to Roy's place. He and Ed are basically dating, so meeting the parents won't seem that out of the ordinary. You should probably tell him who you are, but also I would recommend you just stroll in and start telling stories about Ed's childhood. He'll be crying inside, but he'll roll with it. Greed lets out a low whistle, and Al says, Winry, you're scary. I'm so glad you're my friend. He can't tell for sure. It's pretty dark out, and they just have lamplight to see by, but he thinks Winry is blushing. Because of him? Wow, this is just so not the time. But he's pretty sure she's blushing because of him. Nina absolutely, definitely underestimated the complexity of knitting flesh back together. She can't figure out the right circle for it, to repair her father's throat and his blood loss, to heal his body enough that it can live on its own. If she had more time, she could do it. But her specialization isn't biological alchemy. It's elemental. And she doesn't know enough to come up with a circle to repair this type of damage off the top of her head. Edward or Alphonse could, she's sure. But she doesn't have either of them. Can't have either of them. Because neither of them would help her do this. But she's going to do it anyway. Fixing his body is out. She's just going to have to do this the hard way. It's possible to build a body around a soul. It's what Edward must have done for her, after all. But it takes a lot more energy to unmake and then remake something around a soul. She doesn't have that type of bargaining power, but if she tweaks the soul summoning circle, the soul binding circle just a little, then maybe she can skip a couple of steps. She neither wants nor needs to unmake her father's body, nor does she want to have to put him back together again on the molecular level. So if she can redirect the energy, only need the bit about reconstruction and leave the rest, then, well, then maybe it won't kill her. If she could, she'd repair the damage separately, and this would be almost easy, but she can't, so she'll need Papa's soul to do it for her. She takes out her chalk and starts drawing. One giant circle in the middle of the room. It's only a matter of time before Mom or someone else tries to come in here. She doesn't have much time. Ed feels like his heart is going to squeeze out of his chest. Is this the universe ensuring equivalent exchange invades every facet of his life? He's had one parent return to him, only to lose another. He takes a cab, not wanting to waste time walking, and runs to the front door. There's a small puddle of blood in front of the door. He assumes that's where Mace died. With a quick clap of alchemy, the door's unlocked, and he cautiously steps inside. Gracia? She turns the corner, her sleeves pushed up to her elbows, and her arms scrubbed red and raw, her eyes puffy from crying. Ed, she chokes out, and he doesn't have to think about it, doesn't hesitate. He rushes over, arms open, and she crumples, falling into him and tucking her face into his flesh shoulder. I don't think they're here. If they wanted to kill us, they could have, but God, Edward, he's gone. I know, he says softly, and part of him wonders, could he bring Mace back? But no. He doesn't have the right equivalent exchange. Would need a body to spare and a little something extra to get his soul back, and and he just doesn't have that. He had to kill a dog to get the energy to tear Nina apart and put her back together again. He doesn't know how many people he'd have to kill to do the same for Mace. Gracia is only a couple inches taller than him, but she's slight, so it's easy to hold her upright and whisper soothing nothings in her ear. He has to look around, has to figure out if this is something they can turn over to the authorities or something to do with the homunculi. He desperately wishes Lust were here, because she'd know what to do. She has this air of competence that she never loses, not even when she's upset or furious. It kind of reminds him of Hawkeye. "I have to tell the girls," she says, just barely on the edge of sobbing, but somehow able to hold it back. "They came down earlier, and they went back upstairs, but I didn't tell them. I didn't know what to say." Ed goes cold. There's still blood on the floor from where Gracia had dragged Mace's body. Not a lot. He stopped bleeding once his heart stopped pumping, but enough. "Nina came down here?" Gracia nods. "She's upstairs with Alicia." Ed carefully steps away from Gracia, then goes running to the study where Mace's body has to be. He hopes she's right, that Nina decided to be quietly obedient for once in her life, but he doesn't think that's the case. He goes to open the door, but it doesn't budge. He tries again, and it takes him a full 15 seconds to figure out that the door doesn't exist anymore, that it's been alchemized away. With a clap, it's back and swings open. Alicia is pressed against the wall in the far corner of the room. In the center of the room, Nina kneels next to Mace's body. It's in the middle of an alchemical circle, one not nearly complex enough for what she's trying to do. She looks up and meets his eyes. She doesn't flinch. "Nina, don't!" he calls out, running forward, desperate to stop her from making the same mistake that he and Al did. She slaps her hands onto the circle, and it blazes to life. Ed can't stop her, but he has about a half a second window to do something else. He slams to his knees on the other side of the circle and claps his hands before touching them to the edges. He can't stop her, but he can help her. He just hopes that Al and Roy and, well, a whole bunch of people, really, can forgive him for it. Izumi intends to do as Winry suggests, to break into this colonel's home that's apparently dating her Edward, and maybe knock him around a little, but that's not what happens. Greed and Al are gone, and Winry has just hailed a cab, when Dolcetto frowns, leans his head back, and takes a deep breath. "Do you guys smell that?" Martel rolls her eyes. "We're not part dog, so no." Dolcetto throws her an irritated glance, but says, "I think there's another homunculus here. Not here, but close." "Lust," Roa says, but Dolcetto shakes his head. "It doesn't smell like her. I think it's... He makes a frustrated sound in the back of his throat. "I wouldn't recognize it if it's one we hadn't been near before. It's not lust, so it has to be..." "Gluttony?" Beto suggests, hiding under his large cloak. Martel's mouth curls into a grin that looks predatory. "Wanna go hunting?" "Do we look like alchemists to you?" Roa says. "We can't kill it. All we can do is be killed by it. What will Greed do without us to look after him, huh?" "An alchemist?" Izumi asks, and they all startle like they'd forgotten she and Sig were still there. "Alchemists can kill these things." They're all silent, faces hardening as they stare at her. It takes her a moment to figure out why. Then she can't help the swell of admiration for Greed. Whatever else he may be, he certainly inspires loyalty. "I have no interest in harming your friend. If you need an alchemist to kill this thing, I'll help, and I promise to never use this knowledge to harm Greed." Izumi is fast. She's good. But in between one blink and the next, Martel is right in front of her, a blade pressed to her throat. Sig lets in a startled breath, but Izumi doesn't flinch. If you hurt him, Martell says quietly, I'll kill you. I'll hunt you to the ends of the earth if I need to, until it kills me. We all will. She looks past the woman to the rest of them, and there's that same determination in them, even the little one who isn't anything close to a fighter. Deal, she says, and is satisfied by the surprise that flits across all their faces. Are we going to go kill this thing or not? Trisha throws herself at the barrier, but it's no use. It's like hitting a brick wall. Her whole body is sore, but she can't give up. She can't just sit here. If Mace Hughes is dead, then it's one of them who did it. Since he wasn't eaten, she can only assume it was Envy, the thing her husband created so long ago. Looking at Envy is, to how far from a human he is, just shows her how her son succeeded where her husband failed. She's not like other humans, not even close, but she's still human. Free of the red water, she's still Trisha Elric. Envy is just a thing fueled by anger and fear that sometimes wears the face of a man who may have been her husband's son. If Envy killed Mace Hughes, then he's discovered something about either her or Lust. He's impulsive, without any great ability to think things through or plan for the greater picture. There was a reason that, in spite of being the oldest of them, in spite of knowing father from the very beginning, he wasn't put in any positions of power. Pride as Führer, and Lust to manage the rest of his grand plan. Father had placed her close to Pride as his secretary. She wonders if it was to keep an eye on her. If Father knew, as soon as she was free from the Redwater's influence, she'd go running back to her sons. She slams her body against the barrier once more, but she knows it's hopeless. Her son is a genius. This isn't a cage she'll be able to escape. What are you doing? Yadira is in the doorway, clenching a tray with her dinner in it. Trisha nearly sobs in relief. Please, you have to break the circle. Please. She steps forward warily. Edward said not to let you out, no matter what. He's in trouble, she says. My son is in trouble. This whole country is in trouble. And I can help, but not from here. I'm me. I'm not trying to escape. I'm trying to save my son and everything he's worked for. Please. Envy is so obsessed with instant gratification, with doing and getting exactly what he wants when he wants it, that he probably hadn't gone to report to the father yet. If she hurries, she can find him, and she can stop him. Yadira presses her hands against the barrier, and Trisha places her hands in the same place. I had a son once, Yadira says, face pinched. And all the air leaves Trisha's lungs. Before she can ask, before she can react at all, Yadira puts the food to the side and digs the edge of the tray into the circle. Ed had painted the circle onto the concrete and added a feedback loop so he wouldn't have to constantly maintain it. It takes her almost a minute of pushing the tray into the edge of the circle until she manages to scrape away enough of the paint to break it. The barrier comes down with a fizzle of energy, and Trisha lunges forward. Yadira flinches back, eyes wide and afraid, but Trisha cups her face and presses a kiss to each of her cheeks. Thank you, she whispers, and then she's running upstairs. She pushes the door to Edward's friend's apartment open. Gabby and Saif are sitting at the kitchen table, but Gabby stands at her entrance. Trisha, Ed said it wasn't safe for you to leave. We don't have time for safe. She says, then looks to Saif. I have to go take care of another homunculi. He was acting under orders, but he's directly responsible for the beginning of the Ishvalan War, if that's something you have any interest in. Saif's hands clench into fists, but he just raises an eyebrow. Are you asking for my help to commit murder? Put that arm to good use and help me kill one of the things that is directly responsible for the genocide of your people, instead of wasting it on hapless state alchemists, she says. Gabby puts her head in her hands. Oh my God. Saif turns to Gabby, considering.
I am of your house, and you are of my name. I gave you my word. If you don't want me to go, then I won't.
Gabby peeks between her fingers, then sighs and reaches forward, grabbing Saif's hand between both of her own. He seems startled by her affection. Do what you feel is right. Don't do what you know is not. He squeezes her hands, then stands, straightening his shoulders.
Lead the way, Trisha Elric.
Winry knows something is wrong as soon as she steps out of the cab. All the lights on the bottom floor of the house are still on, and she expects Mace to still be awake. He always works late, but not the others. Then she sees the golden glow of alchemy, shining so brightly that it's leaking through the curtains, and she rushes to the front door. She sees a small puddle of blood by the door, but doesn't have the time to worry about it. Instead, grabbing the handle and trying to yank the door open. It's locked, of course. For a moment, Winry considers trying to break through before she remembers she's not an idiot. She swings open her bag and takes out a pair of pliers, prying the pins out of the hinges on the door so she can swing it open from the other direction. It cracks and hangs at an awkward angle. She owes the Hugheses a door now. She has to shield her eyes from the light of the alchemical reaction. She bumps into Gracia in the hallway, who's holding Alicia, pressing her daughter's face into her chest while she squints against the light. What's going on? Winry yells, because somehow it's deadly silent and a roar in her ears all at once. Gracia reaches for her, grabbing her wrist and anchoring her to her side. She doesn't even question Winry's presence, only shakes her head and shouts back, I don't know! Ed and Nina are in there! Winry only knows one type of alchemy that has a byproduct of golden light. The only question is, which of the two of them was stupid enough to try human transmutation? Martell hadn't expected this woman to be much of a fighter, this ailing housewife who'd apparently been the armor's teacher way back when. She was wrong. Beto doesn't fight, so they send him to the rooftop to keep an eye on things, to be able to go and get Greed if something goes horribly wrong. Martell remembers when Greed had come and busted them out of that lab. They'd been the ones that stuck with him, but he'd let everyone go, and they'd all ran for it. Except Beto. He'd been too sick, too weak. He wasn't a perfect chimera, not like them. And the scientists had left him to die. Greed had broken into his cell and carried the man out himself, saying the whole time it was just because he needed someone small and quick, just like he kept saying that he only kept them around because they were useful. But Martell had never bought that, even if maybe the boys did. Greed cared for them, had nursed Beto back to health himself, and Martell wouldn't be the cause of the Gecko Chimera's death if she could help it. She expects it to be the three of them against Gluttony, her and Roa and Dolcetto, and when they can maybe pin him down for long enough, for the alchemist lady to come forward and do her thing. That's not what happens. The woman and her husband hang back for about 30 seconds, then they jump in, and the husband is impressive, but the woman is incredible. She's fast and strong, using alchemy as easily as breathing, and between them they manage to keep Gluttony in one place long enough for the woman to slap her hands on him and channel his energy out of him, through her and into the ground. Roa attempts to gag the homunculus with a steel beam, doing his best to keep the thing from making too much noise, and the beam cuts into his arms. Luckily, not many people are by the train station this late at night, and those that aren't stupid enough to go towards the sound of fighting. They're all hurt, bleeding and bruised, but nothing fatal. Nothing that won't easily heal with a little rest. Being a chimera comes with its advantages. When the woman is finished, she leans over and vomits what looks like half her internal organs. But the homunculus is dead, nothing more than a skeleton in a pile of red water.
The thought of this happening to Greed makes her blood boil, and she prays to every god she's forsaken that Izumi Curtis doesn't go back on her word. Martell doesn't know if she'll be able to kill her without being killed herself, and it will be so disappointing if her death is in vain. Nina is smart. She's an actual genius, and Ed has never been more grateful for that than he is right now. Her array is good. It's not balanced properly, but he fixes that, channeling the energy through him before releasing it back into the circle so it doesn't ricochet back on her. She's guiding most of it, generating power that's being let out in light and sound waves so she can harness it again. A circle within a circle. And Edward would be impressed if he wasn't so horrified. She finishes, and she's being delicate, being careful. But this is human transmutation, so Edward closes his eyes and braces himself for the moment they're ripped away and brought to the gate. This is the third time Ed's been here now, and it's just the same as before. Pure white wherever he looks, except for the gate behind him and the gate in front of him, and Truth front and center, a fuzzy outline almost in the shape of a person. "Brother!" Nina's fist slams into his side, and she's a kid, but she's strong enough that he winces. She grabs the front of his shirt, furious, and jerks him down so she can glare into his eyes. "What are you doing here? This wasn't supposed to involve you!" "What were you thinking?" he snaps. "Have I taught you nothing? Has growing up with me and Al taught you nothing? You don't mess with human transmutation." "That's rich coming from you," she says. "So it's only okay if it's your mom, if it's your little sister. You did it for me. Of course I do it for Papa." He shakes his head. "It wasn't the same with you. You were all messed up. I just had to take you apart and put you together. It's not the same." Then he pauses and pales. "Wait, how do you even know about that?"
"Enough,"
Truth rasps, voice slick like oil. Nina shivers when she hears it, but lets Ed go and steps away from him.
"You've opened the gate. Now it's time to pay the price."
It doesn't have eyes, but Ed can feel the Truth's gaze on him anyway, and it makes his stomach roll.
"If it were not for his interference, your body would be forfeit. But he redirected the energy that otherwise would have been lost, so that is no longer the price."
"Sorry," he says offhand, not meaning it at all. "You shouldn't have burdened me with knowledge you didn't want me to use." The one feature Truth seems to have is a mouth, and maybe that's what makes its smile so horrifying.
"Are you looking for more knowledge, child? You have some ignorance left to bargain."
It's talking about how to get his brother's body back. The gate hates him as much as an otherworldly being is capable of hate. The only reason it would offer to help him is if doing so would hurt him. But it is the gate. It can't trick him, can't lie. It's bound by the same rules of equivalencies that they all are. He hated having that thing in his head, those black tendrils cracking him open and peeling him apart. But it's for Al. What wouldn't he sacrifice? What part of himself wouldn't he give up for his brother? By the way it's smiling, it's clear it knows Ed's answer. "Hey," Nina says, pushing Ed back and stepping in front of him. "This isn't why we're here. This isn't what the circle was for."
"Are you ready to pay the price, child?"
it asks. And the way it looks at Nina isn't the way it looks at Ed, for a given definition of look, considering it doesn't have eyes. It's kinder, if such a thing were possible. Her hands clench into fists, and when she speaks, it's more of a snarl. "Give me my daddy back!" The gate behind Truth bursts open, doors open wide, black tendrils rush forth, and Ed instantly loses sight of Truth.
He tries to reach for Nina before they're overtaken, but she's already gone. Trisha catches up with Envy when he's almost back to base. He's taking his sweet time, because what's the point of rushing, really? He's not going to live to regret that. Saif looks at her, a single eyebrow raised.
Are you ready, Trisha Elric?
She grins, energy running over her so she's not in borrowed clothes, not in her suit skirt that she wears when assisting the Führer, but in dark, skin-tight clothes that won't get in the way while she's fighting. They don't have time for Trisha to make fun of Saif for the way his eyes momentarily dip too low to be polite. Unfortunately. Let's go. I've already died once. What's the worst that can happen? Al and Greed are almost to the unofficial Ishvalan district when there's a sound like a building falling and faint red energy in the distance. They look at each other.
We could just keep walking, Greed points out.
Al sighs, because while that's very tempting, it's also very irresponsible. Alchemist, be thou for the people.
Come on.
Greed shrugs, and as he does, his whole body shifts, his skin becoming carbon. When they get to the fight, Al doesn't think there's anything in the world that could have prepared him for what he sees. Saif is fighting against a short man in a crop top and long, spiky hair. Helping him is...
Who knew Sloth had it in her? Greed says in wonder. Well, I don't know who this other guy is, but Envy is a dick. Let's get to work.
Traitor! Envy howls, lashing out at Greed, who dances out of the way.
You know you can't win like this, he says, grinning. You might as well bring out your true form.
Are you trying to destroy this whole street? The woman, Sloth, who has his mother's face and memories and, if Ed's letter is to be believed, her soul, who is, if all that is true, his mom. They're managing to keep Envy contained, but now that Al is looking closer, he can see that they're both hurt. Saif is leaning heavily on one leg, the other bloodied and almost useless, while Sloth, Trisha, mom, he decides on, has what looks like claw marks across her stomach, though they don't seem to be bothering her much, if at all.
None of us are alchemists, Greed says, flinching as Envy's boot attempts to kick through his chest. So unless you have a piece of his original body hanging around, I'm not sure what you're trying to achieve.
Al is usually quicker than this, but seeing his mom has unbalanced him leaves him feeling slow. He keeps thinking of the gate, of that horrible transmutation that went so wrong, that cost him and his brother everything. Of the gate tearing him apart and dragging him past its doors, of the darkness and cold and fear until brother pulled his soul out again. But wait, he can't remember anything after activating the circle. How is he?
I can deconstruct,
Saif grunts, driving out of the way of Envy's attack.
If he would just stop moving.
They need the homunculus restrained. And he can do that. He draws a quick circle, presses his hands to it. The asphalt springs to life, wrapping around Envy. He's strong enough to break out of it, so Al doesn't let his control on the ground go. Keeps it shifting and partially liquid, so it absorbs the force of Envy's attacks instead of being broken apart by it. Saif doesn't hesitate, dragging himself forward and pressing his hand to Envy's forehead. The complex almost circles on Saif's arm flares to life, and Al knows it's working by the homunculus's screams.
Al, get over here, Greed calls out. We need a real alchemist. He won't be able to do this on his own.
He can't control the ground and help them at the same time. He puts down a final burst of power into the circle and runs, hoping he'll get there in time. Envy throws Saif off of him, face half melted away, and breaks free from Al's restraints.
Greed and Mom rush forward to pin him down on either side, and without thinking, Al claps his hands together and slams them against Envy's chest. For a horrible second, he thinks he's made a terrible mistake, that he's cost them precious seconds. But then his hands activate the array in his mind, without him actually having to draw it out, and it's no wonder that Saif was struggling. Deconstruction is easy, comparatively. Taking something apart is always so much easier than putting it back together. But Saif isn't an alchemist. He doesn't understand what he's deconstructing. And people so often forget that understanding is a foundation of alchemy, as necessary as deconstruction and reconstruction. Envy is made up of too many things, of so many dense and varied elements, that it's impossible to effectively attack them all at once. Instead, he has to do it narrowly, undo pieces of him at a time. He knows he's succeeding by the anguished cries coming out of Envy's mouth.
"Don't let up, kid," Greed's voice says in his ear. "If you do, he'll have the chance to transform, and then we're fucked."
Okay, no pressure. He can do this. He can do this, is the thing. And once he manages to tune out Envy's screaming, it's almost like a game, going through the table of elements and ticking them off, one by one, as he destroys Envy on a molecular level. He doesn't know how much time has passed, but when he finishes, he's kneeling in a puddle of red water. In front of him is a baby's skeleton. He doesn't have a body, but he still feels sick. Greed's boot enters his vision, before coming down on the skeleton, shattering it. The pieces rest in the red water for a moment before crumbling to dust.
"Good riddance," Greed says. "We're gonna have to clean up the red water. It can't really be deconstructed, only used. Anyone got a bottle on them? Maybe a funnel? Or even just a really absorbent towel?"
"Alphonse!" Someone tugs at him, and he twists to look at his mother's face. It really is her. Worried, warm, brown eyes and all. "Are you okay? You're not hurt, are you?" He opens his mouth to answer, to tell her he's fine, but what comes out is as close to crying as he can get like this. "Mom?" He saw her fighting, saw her body easily switching from liquid to solid, knows what she is. But if his lack of a normal human body doesn't make him any less human, he doesn't see why it would for his mother either.
"Oh, Alphonse," she says, and wraps her arms around him.
He can't feel it, not really, just the light pressure of her limbs. But he hugs her back anyway.
"I've missed you so much."
"I missed you too," he whispers. Brother is missing two limbs. He is missing his whole body. And he can't say that the past 5 years have been anything close to easy. But his mom is hugging him. He has his mom back. And in this moment, he doesn't regret a single decision he and brother made that led them here. Nina can't see or hear anything, is weightless in the dark, but she can feel the dark tendrils of the gate covering her body. "Make your deal with me," she says, and she can't hear herself, but she knows she's speaking. "Don't take anything more from Edward. Take it from me instead." The tendrils leave, and she can't see truth in front of her, but she knows it's there.
"Are you sure? I can't make it hurt less for you. The price is the same."
"It's equivalent exchange," she says. "Ed helped me, now I'm helping him. Give me the knowledge you were gonna give him, and my ignorance will be forfeit. My innocence forfeit. Don't make the exchange with him. He has too many nightmares already." Silence. Nina isn't above begging if she has to. There's a sound, almost like a sigh, then a feeling like a hand on her shoulder. She knows the exchange has been made when her head hurts so much she can't stop screaming.
"Roy doesn't understand how this could have happened. Doesn't understand precisely what has happened. All he knows is that Alex had burst into his office in the middle of the night, not even in uniform, and said that Mace was dead, said that Roy had to get to the Hugheses as soon as possible, and that he couldn't let anyone know he was doing it. He'd broken a few dozen traffic laws to get here, and grief is clawing in his heart, but he can't let it have him. Not yet. His best friend may be dead, but if he lets anything happen to Mace's wife and daughters because he was too busy mourning, he'll never forgive himself. Mace will never forgive him either. The front door is open, broken at the hinges, and his heart is in his throat as he runs inside. But he's two steps in the door when the oppressive weight of alchemical energy sends him to his knees. And he can see Gracia, Alicia, and, for some reason, Winry, sitting in front of the door to Mace's study, equally as pinned by the pressure as he is. Then, all at once, it's gone, and he can breathe again. He recognizes this. It's what he felt just before Ed activated the circle to save Nina. Nina, who's smart and gifted and just as terrifying as the Elric brothers, and who Roy doesn't have eyes on right now. Roy and Winry bolt for the study, while Gracia remains sitting with Alicia. The golden light fades, and he sees Ed on one side of the circle and Nina on the other, and Mace's body in the middle, his throat slashed. Then it's not. Golden light zips across Mace's throat, leaving behind a jagged scar. The circle sizzles, and both Nina and Edward are pushed back from it. Mace's eyes pop open, and he gasps to life, rolling over on his side and coughing. Ed is rubbing at his head, dazed and confused, while Nina digs the heel of her palms into her eyes, tears running down her cheeks. Winry rushes past them to Mace's side, rubbing a hand up and down his back with one hand and opening her bag with the other. She pulls out a stethoscope, saying something low and soothing as she pops it in her ears and presses it to Mace's back. He still can't seem to stop coughing. "I can't see!" Nina cries, crawling forward on her hands and knees. Her formerly brown eyes are clouded over. "Is he okay? Did I do it? Is Papa okay? Did I bring Daddy back? I want to see!" Nina is blind. Mace looks up, and Roy is terrified of what he'll see. But he just looks like his best friend, like he always has. He tries to speak, but can't. Loses himself to a coughing fit instead. He pushes himself to his knees, crawling past Winry towards his daughter. Ed is shaking his head from side to side, like he's trying to shake everything back in place. Is Ed okay? Is he still the same man he was before, or has the gate taken even more from him and left someone else in his place? Winry moves to help, but she's too slow. Mace reaches Nina first, grabbing her hands and mouth working silently, trying to speak to her. Her face lights up. "Daddy!" she cries. And she'd refused to call Mace that for so long, had only called him Papa. But it seems she no longer has to contend with balancing two fathers. To her, the only dad she has is Mace. She pushes herself up onto her knees and throws her arms around him, and he wraps her in a tight hug, shoulders shaking as he clutches her. But his sobs only come out in gasping, hitching breaths. "Mace?" Gracia asks, voice trembling, and she steps into the room with Alicia on her hip. He looks up and he's crying, but he smiles, keeping one arm around Nina's waist, but holding out the other towards his wife. Gracia bursts into tears and runs to him, and Alicia is crying too, and they cling to Mace and Nina. Roy sits next to Ed, dumbfounded, trying to wrap his head around what apparently just happened, and failing. Winry looks at the crying family with a soft expression, then huffs and goes over to Ed, nodding to Roy before placing her hands on her best friend's knees.
"What the hell, Ed?"
"Not my idea," he says, and Roy breathes a sigh of relief when Ed still sounds like Ed. "She'd already activated the array when I came in, and I couldn't... It was good. It was almost perfect, but I couldn't let her risk that alone."
"Of course not," Winry says. "She's our little sister. Are you okay? All your limbs still attached?"
The answer's obviously yes, but his face darkens, and Roy can see the alarm he feels mirrored on Winry's face. I think Nina did something.
Yeah, genius. She performed human transmutation, Winry says.
Ed glares at her.
No, I mean, it didn't take anything from me. It didn't hurt me, and it wanted to. So if it didn't do it to me, I think...
He means to look towards Nina, but his eyes get caught on Roy, and he blinks in surprise. Apparently he hadn't noticed Roy sitting 6 inches away from him for the past few minutes.
Roy!
Ed, he says tiredly, I'm glad you're all right. I've been worried about you these past couple of days. He stares at him, golden eyes narrowed and mouth pulled into a frown.
I thought I was gonna die or come back broken if I came back at all. You know what I was really pissed at myself for not having done?
Roy doesn't get a chance to answer, because Ed lunges forward and pushes him to the ground. His head hits the wood floor with a painful whack, and he means to ask Ed what the hell he's up to when he climbs on top of him, thighs bracketing his hips and hands on either side of his head. He leans down, covering Roy's mouth with his own, and this is completely inappropriate for so many reasons, but he can't bring himself to care. Mace is alive, and Edward is alive, warm and kissing him, and that's all that really matters. He grabs the back of Ed's neck and twists them, being more considerate of Ed's head than he'd been of his, and burying his hands in Edward's golden hair as he keeps kissing him, lips and tongue and teeth, and Ed's laughter bubbling between them.
Uncle Roy, sitting in a tree, K-I-S-S-I-N-G. First comes love, then comes marriage, then comes a baby in a baby carriage. Big brother and Uncle Roy sitting in a tree.
Roy and Ed part and look over. Winry is leading Alicia and Nina in the schoolyard chant, while Mace looks on amused, with Gracia curled into his side, a hand over her mouth in a poor attempt to hide her giggles. Think of the children, Edward, he says, flushed and breathless. Ed grins up at him, hair having come out of his braid at some point and creating a golden halo around him.
Biology is an important lesson and a foundation for later learning, he says, seriously, before pulling Roy back down for another kiss.
Hohenheim is depressingly easy to track down. Then again, she supposes he was never really hiding. Not from them. You need to come with me, she says. He looks at her, so very old and so very sad. Is the dwarf in the flask trying to move the timetable up? I can't go yet. I suppose I'll have to kill you now. I'm sorry. Lust takes a couple of steps back, hands raised, because as a sacrifice he's one of the very few people capable of killing a homunculus without using their human counterpart's remains. The Elric brothers and their teacher are the others. Hohenheim frowns at her actions, not understanding.
Whoa, relax. I'm not here to fight. I'm on your side. Or, well, I'm on Edward's side.
My son? He frowns. What does he have to do with any of this? Lost stares.
Are you trying to be funny?
He blinks at her.
I'll explain on the way, she says impatiently, because apparently being ancient makes you an idiot.
But your sons need your help against father. We have to hurry. The dwarf in the flask will not make any moves until the promised day, he says, slow and still so sad. Lust feels less and less bad for him, the more idiotic things he says.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure he's going to make a move way earlier than that, she says. You see, I defected, and so did Sloth, and we're basically ruining a whole bunch of carefully laid plans. Father is moving now, so if you want to actually be useful, we have to get to Central. She's pretty sure he doesn't know who, exactly, Sloth is.
He keeps staring at her. She'd save them all some time and just pick him up and carry him over her shoulder if she wasn't afraid he'd unmake her if she got too close. Oh, he settles on finally. That's unexpected. Lust wants to stab herself in the eye. It'll probably hurt less. Yes, life is full of unexpected things. Can we go now? I suppose, he says, still not moving. He does take off his glasses to clean the lenses with a handkerchief. She wants to scream. Two alchemically modified immortal beings can move pretty fast when they have to, so they can be back in Central by midday if they hurry. He doesn't seem like the type of man who hurries. Maybe carrying him is worth the risk, if it'll get them there faster. Greed can't help but be just a little amused at the image of Trisha carrying Saif on her back, his leg expertly bandaged by Al. She's strong enough to carry the weight of 5 times his and not notice it. But the image of this slight woman carrying a man the size of Saif like it's nothing is hilarious. His amusement drains away when he catches sight of Beto scuttling towards him. Where are the others? He barks. Beto grabs onto his arm, tail twitching back and forth in agitation. Mr. Greed, everyone is okay, mostly. They're hurt, but not badly. But the alchemist lady, she threw up so much blood. Teacher? Al asks. She does that sometimes. They all give him a weird look, but he doesn't bother to explain further. Why is anyone hurt? Greed asks, letting Beto keep holding onto his arm because he knows it makes him feel better. They fought one like you, Mr. Greed. Gluttony. Panic settles into his gut, because only someone who's been through the gate and back would have the power to unmake a homunculus. Something he'd neglected to tell them because he didn't think it would ever come up, because there's only a handful of people that combination of smart and stupid and brave. The alchemist lady killed him, but she's ill. We have to help. He blinks. All the anxiety that had been building inside of him leaving all at once. He hadn't known she'd been through the gate. Usually alchemists that are talented enough to make it back from the gate leave a homunculus behind, but she hadn't. Is everyone okay? Little things, Beto insists. They will heal by morning, but the woman! I heard you, he says, absently patting him on the head. He turns to the others. I have to go get my people. I'll catch up. I'll go too, Al sighs. Hopefully Winry is having a better time at the Hugheses. Trisha freezes, and Saif winces. Greed doesn't like the look on either of their faces, even a little bit. She went to the Hugheses? Yeah, Al says, suddenly wary. Why? Giddy elation dims and practicalities settle in. Winry drags both Nina and Mace to their spare room, insisting on giving them both a complete examination. She threatens to do the same to Edward, but he tells Roy that he figures he can avoid that for a while. He hadn't lost his sight or come back from the dead, so he assumes he's pretty low on her priority list. Ed fixes the front door and gets rid of the bloodstains. Now that things have settled and she doesn't have the adrenaline to stay awake, Alicia crashes hard, asleep in her mother's arms. Gracia brings her upstairs to put her to bed, and Roy's just finished making a pot of coffee, since he doesn't think anyone else is going to be able to get any sleep tonight. The door bangs open, and Roy already has his hand poised to snap, and he's comforted to see Ed bolt out of the study, automail transformed into a blade. There's the clang of armor, and Roy slumps in relief. It's just Alphonse. Brother! Al cries, and Ed gives him a tired grin and transforms his arm back. Mr. Hughes is dead? He shakes his head. A temporary affliction, he says wryly. Nina is a genius, but she's also an idiot. Then he frowns. You're back a few hours earlier than I expected. Where's that person I told you to find? Before Al has a chance to answer, practically a whole parade of people enter the house. Ed's eyebrows raise to his hairline. There's a man with two sharp teeth, and four people who don't seem exactly like people. "Heard you were looking for me," the man says, leaning against the wall and leering down at Ed. "Where's Lust?" "She's getting the last piece of our very messed up puzzle," he says. "Glad you could join us, Greed."
"Just because you're part animal doesn't mean you were raised in a barn,"
a woman's voice calls out.
"Don't just leave the door open."
Ed frowns.
"Mom, what are you doing here? Is everything okay with Aviv and Gabby? You shouldn't have left the barrier."
"Mom, who on earth is he talking to?" Greed and his companions spill into the living room to make room. Roy has only seen pictures, of course, but a woman who looks eerily similar to Trisha Elric walks down the hall. She's carrying the mass murderer's scar on her back.
"Everything's fine. You should call Gabby and tell her that, though. She must be worried. The homunculus who killed your friend was going to cause problems, so I had to take care of him. Al said Winry was here. This man needs a doctor."
Ed winces and rubs the back of his head.
About that.
Attracted by the noise, Mace, Nina, and Winry wander in from the kitchen. Her mouth drops open, and Roy has to admit she sounds exactly like a mother when she snaps.
"Edward, you didn't! You know how dangerous human transmutation is!"
"It was my fault,"
Nina says, carefully stepping forward, trying not to knock into anything or anyone.
"I performed the transmutation. Edward just helped. All he did was redirect the energy."
Her face smooths out, apparently mollified.
"Mrs. Elric?"
Winry whispers, eyes wide.
"Winry," she says warmly, "you've grown into such a beautiful young woman and so smart. Your parents would be so proud of the doctor and mechanic you've become. I know I am."
The woman is Trisha Elric, apparently, which he would say was impossible, except he's just witnessed a successful human transmutation performed by an 11-year-old girl, so his measure of impossible has been effectively shattered once more. He takes a moment to consider the idea of 9-year-old Edward and 8-year-old Alphonse successfully performing human transmutation, and it gives him such a headache that he has to stop immediately. By Winry's surprise, he's at least reassured this is a recent development. Going by what Ed has told him, this probably means she was a homunculus. But isn't anymore? Or still is one, but not like the others. Once they have 30 seconds to catch their breath, Roy is going to have to insist Ed fill him in on what's been going on these past couple of days. Winry bolts forward and Trisha hurriedly slides Scar off her back onto the couch so she can catch the girl when she launches herself at her, pressing her face into Trisha's shoulder. The door opens and shuts once more.
"Took you long enough,"
Greed's female companion yells out. One of the men, with what Roy thinks are horns on his head, sighs. "It really would have been faster if you just let one of us carry you." A woman with dark hair and a ferocious scowl hobbles in, a large man hovering anxiously at her side.
"I can walk by my damn self."
Ed's mouth drops open in surprise. Roy's grateful he's caught off guard by at least some of tonight's events.
"Teacher? What are you doing here?"
The woman points a finger at Ed, who gulps.
"As soon as I get my strength back, I'm gonna kick your ass."
"Izumi Curtis!"
Trisha leaves Winry's side to grab the woman's outstretched hand in her own.
"Thank you so much for looking after my sons. I can never repay you."
She turns to the man, smiling.
"Both of you, of course."
Izumi slowly blinks once, then twice, then says,
"What the fuck?"
"My eldest must have gotten his mouth from you,"
Trisha says, but instead of scandalized, she looks delighted. Winry snorts from her place, treating Scar's leg. Nina turns to her father's side to hide her smile, and Mace curls his arm around her and raises an eyebrow. While the scar around his neck is hardly pretty, Roy has to say he looks pretty good for a man that was dead a couple of hours ago. Gracia has just reached the bottom step after putting Alicia to bed, but apparently she's run out of the energy to be surprised tonight, because she just raises an eyebrow.
It looks like we're gonna need more coffee.